Hello, and welcome to Nostalgium Arcanum. I'm your host, Doug Leaf. Each week on this podcast, we examine the sea urchin, porcupines of the sea, their glorious spines reaching toward the heavens in defiance of God's plan, their spirits indefatigable, their intellects inscrutable. Why have we devoted an entire podcast to the veneration of these underwater pincushions? Why did I bother to specialize in them at university? And how in the world can I afford to eat on a sea urchin specialist salary? I'll tell you why, Mother. You, with your critical words and your artificial knees and your bloody sea urchin bigotry. It's because...
All right then, stop that. This is quite silly. Well, now that we've disposed of that nonsense, it's time to get on with it. Take it away, Mr. Man at the Desk.
And now for something completely different.
Monty Python's a flying circus.
Somewhere between Saturday Night Live and the absurdist writings of Lewis Carroll lies Monty Python's Flying Circus, one of the most influential comedy troupes of all time, and a completely manic and weird entry for this for our Nostalgium Arcanum podcast. I am beyond excited to talk about this. I've had this on my short list for a long, long time to talk about. Monty Python is eminently quotable, inscrutable, and equal parts hilarious and baffling. So we're going to get into all of that today. One little thing to mention up top. We're only talking about Monty Python's Flying Circus, the television show. We're not going to be talking, at least spending any length of time on the movies, Life of Brian, Holy Grail, or Meaning of Life. Why? Because why would I burden that? Those would be three awesome episodes because, goddammit, I love Monty Python. So we'll be back to talk about those movies at some point, I'm sure. But let's get underway. It is not just me. I have two guests with me today. First, you have heard him on many of our prior episodes, including most recently RoboCop and Mitch Hedberg. He is a performer with West Side Comedy Theater from time to time, and I just love having him here. So please welcome back Rich Baker.
Thanks as always, Doug. I appreciate being here.
You're very welcome anytime you like. And joining me is his co-host from his old podcast, Lost and Confounded. Please welcome to the show, Ned Record.
Hey, how's it going? Nice to meet you, Doug.
Nice to meet you, Ned. Thank you both for coming on to talk about Monty Python. Rich, this actually came up when we were talking on a prior episode, and as soon as you said Monty Python, like all the bells and whistles went off in my brain. I'm like, yay, we get to talk about Monty Python finally. So I'll start with you. Tell me about your nostalgic memories of Monty Python's Flying Circus.
For people who've heard me on previous episodes, I've invoked my brother a lot because he's 14 years older than me. So when I was like first 5 years of my life, he was in high school and just out of it. And so he was really into a lot of pop culture and got me into a lot of things way before my time, including Flying Circus. Now, we were early adopters of the VHS, the cutting edge technology of the early 80s. And so he had actually taped a lot of them from, PBS that was showing them, or I don't remember where they were airing, but he taped a lot of them. So I was watching Flying Circus as like a 4 year old on a VHS, you know, recording of, you know, a rebroadcast of a British show in America 10 years after it aired.
Perfect. I have some thoughts on that, but I'll save that. So I'll, Ned, tell me about your nostalgic memories of Monty Python.
My memories start in fifth grade at the beginning of my degenerate nature. Somehow in fifth grade managed to fail half of my classes because I wasn't doing tests and homework, and I was subsequently grounded. I wasn't allowed to watch television. That was my parents' grounding, but their only condition was that I could watch PBS because it was educational television, the public broadcasting stuff and all that. And funny thing is that at least where we were, PBS, Channel 13, if I remember correctly,
yep.
Rich, aired British comedies, usually starting at about 9 o'clock at night. So come about 10, 10:30, on came Monty Python. So since I could only watch PBS, I watched the hell out of PBS and started watching a lot of Monty Python, and it went from there.
You know, my experience with them is sort of similar to yours, Rich, but my dad, we did have the VHS, but he had been an early adopter of a different early technology, which was 8-track tapes. And he had taped onto 8-track tapes, which were sort of like the precursors to cassettes, all of these airings of the Dr. Demento show, which if younger members of the audience don't know, Dr. Demento hosted a radio show where he would play novelty records and comedy stuff. And that's like where Weird Al got his big break. And buried in between all of these novelty songs were occasional Monty Python sketches. Three of them that I remember hearing vividly, and all of which will show up on my list tonight, as a matter of fact. But I had forgotten about, I didn't know they were Monty Python. I just thought these are some three funny things I had heard.
Yeah.
And then I got really into Douglas Adams, the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I was primed with like this very British sense of humor. And I was about somewhere in elementary school when I found that. And then one day in seventh grade, I don't know why, maybe we were doing a unit on medieval culture or something. The teacher put on Holy Grail.
Wow.
And I had to be very careful to let people not see that I had peed my pants laughing.
Wow.
Because that was one of the funniest things I had ever seen in my life. And at that point, I was all in. I devoured Flying Circus. I actually got books in eighth grade. They sold these things called Monty Python, All the Words, which was the complete script to every episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Read them cover to cover. I played all of the like weird interactive CD-ROM games they put out in the 90s. Like I
remember that.
I went hardcore on Monty Python. So, yeah, again, no surprise why I'm chomping at the bit to talk about this. Do you guys have a favorite member of the troupe?
I kind of figured you were going to ask this, and so the short answer is no, I don't have a favorite, but as like a sketch comedian and an actor, like if I was thinking about which one of them, like all the roles combined and the style that they did, like which one I would like to be, I think it would be Terry Jones, because he, to me, was like the most understated of them all, but really, really powerful.
Yeah, I could see that. For me, it's John Cleese, just purely because, I mean, even watching back through some of the episodes to narrow down my 10, just his ability to retain and spout out words so rapid fire, like it just, I can see where that had such a huge influence on like my own professional career.
Nice.
Yeah, I love all of the Pythons. We should just mention them by name. It's you know, John Cleese and Terry Jones, as you mentioned, Eric Idle, Michael Palin, Graham Chapman, and Terry Gilliam. Although Terry Gilliam's contributions are mostly the animation that helps stitch the show together. He performed on occasion. There's also some like sort of honorary members of Monty Python, in particular Neil Innes and Carol Cleveland, who they would use in a lot of sketches.
Yeah, Carol.
My favorite, Terry Jones is way up there for me because I think he doesn't, you know, the others tend to be more recognized. But I love Graham Chapman so much.
Sure.
What a great talent. So for people who don't know, he's the one who plays King Arthur in Holy Grail. And unfortunately, a casualty of the AIDS epidemic in the early 80s. But just a monster talent, but all of them, you're right. Like there isn't a weak member of the group. They are all very, very good at all of the things that a comedian would be called upon to do, whether it's, as you said, spouting off a long string of nonsense or physical comedy, you know, everything you would need. There's no weak link in the chain. It's very impressive.
Yeah, which is probably, I mean, they were like the Led Zeppelin of comedy. You know, they were a super group, and they proved themselves.
And
absolutely.
And they were friends of the Beatles. Like, they literally hung out with them. And I mentioned this on our Beatles episode, I think, but if you can go find it, there's a mockumentary that was made called All You Need Is Cash. And it was a joking mockumentary, you know, of the Ruddles, this fake band. Mm. and it spoofs the rise and fall of the Beatles' career, but it is this wonderful marriage between Monty Python and the original cast of Saturday Night Live. It was produced by Lorne Michaels. Eric Idle is one of the main people in the band. John Belushi's in it and Bill Murray's in it. And like, so it's like all of these like heavy hitters on one project, and it's pretty awesome. I'm curious, since both of you mentioned your professional career, Ned, do you feel like Monty Python played a role in shaping your sense of humor, or it affects the way you perform? Or
yeah, definitely my sense of humor, but also I have 2 degrees in Shakespeare. And a lot of that genuinely came from some of the things like the Holy Grail, just that nature of it. And I specialized in clownish comedy, actually moved to England to go to grad school for it. And while it wasn't, I moved to England specifically because of Monty Python, it was definitely that British style, that dry wit, that just the intelligence of it that made me want to pursue that pathway in my acting career.
Hell yeah.
Rich,
yeah, kind of similar to me, actually, and just that, like, but I would say that the thing that I gravitated toward the most and that I enjoyed the most on the rewatch was the cadence and the musicality of the scenes. Of like, I was they really kind of da 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 da. It's like you can almost drum beat to it, and I'd say Monty Python taught me that you can flow and have rhythm, and you can be absolutely absurdist while playing it super, super straight, but in a different way than like Airplane, which is also, slapsticky kind of thing. But this is much more like absurdist, Dadaism, that kind of thing.
Yeah, the commitment to the bit is really impressive here. I was picking that up when I was rewatching this and going, you know, the only way some of this stuff works is that they play everything absolutely 100% real, no matter how silly the subject is. And it's the only, like, this stuff would absolutely fall flat if not for like them giving it 110% on that axis. I also think the writing, this will come out as we talk about the sketches, but it's really unconventional, not only because a lot of the stuff is random, but because structurally there are almost no sketches that follow what you would call a traditional sketch structure, especially where most, you go to the obvious choice, SNL, most sketches want to end with kind of da 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 bump, and a big kind of joke at the end that makes everything come full circle. Monty Python rarely does that. They almost invariably just sort of have one thing flow into the next. It's like, Picasso for sketches.
Yeah. And not in every sketch, I don't think, but in most sketches, at least one, if not multiple characters, dies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they'll do all kinds of random stuff like that. But as you mentioned, Ned, like the wit, right? There's an erudition to this where, sometimes their stuff is very, fart jokey, stupid stuff, aggressively so. But then, yeah, there's a lot of stuff where it's like, I feel like I learned a lot about history and, Shakespeare and all of these subjects. They're operating on this. Like I mentioned Lewis Carroll, like there's like these people understand like logic under the hood, like logical structure and philosophical thought at like a granular level to be able to do some of this stuff so weirdly and effectively.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And a couple of the sketches that I picked kind of showcase that, how you can just go for the lowest brow dumb joke and have so much intelligence behind it.
Yeah.
Like so much thought, so much intelligence, so much. It's such a, I like Rich talking about the musicality. It's my enjoyment of Monty Python sort of sticks to the same. It's the same reason I like certain bands other than others. It's not a genre. It's the lyrics, it's the flow, it's the, are you being clever without winking at me the whole time? And with Monty Python, I always felt that if they're winking at you, they are literally winking at you. It's not this new style of like, did you get it? Did you get it? Let's pause and wait sure they got it. It's like, no, they trust you to get it or they bowled right over it.
Yeah. So I'm curious, so as we've sort of alluded to, we made top 10 lists of our favorite Monty Python Flying Circus sketches. Rich, what criterion did you use to make your list?
So I was, I knew you'd ask that because that's, forever the episode. And I was trying to think of it, and I'd like to be sophisticated about it. But the truth is, the ones that made me laugh the most on the rewatch. That's simple.
Who could argue with that? Yeah. Ned, how about you?
So when Rich first told me about this and we talked about me coming on the episode, I said to Rich, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to sit down. I'm going to watch every single episode and I'm going to make a comprehensive list. I'm going to treat this like I was writing my dissertation. And then I ran out of time. So the 10 I picked were the ones that I picked 10 that had just stuck with me, that for whatever reason, after all these years, after having seen pretty much every episode, they were the ones that just kind of still were taking up real estate in my brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took a slightly different approach, but not much. I tried to think of sketches that obviously, you know, heavy bias towards how did I react the first time I watched them, right? How hard did these hit me when I was 13 and, yeah, you know, just having a good time peeing myself, you know, watching Monty Python and Diapers, you know, but like, yeah, how hard did it make me laugh the first time? And then I tried to also make sure I had a representative sample of like what they would do. They have certain sketch types that they do. So yeah, like, for example, their most famous sketch, which may or may not come up tonight, is Dead Parrot. You know, structure of the Dead Parrot sketch is, you know, man comes into a store and, mm-hmm, you know, is very frustrated by the fact that he can't get what he wants from the shopkeep. They have many sketches in that mold. So I tried to only pick one of those. Yeah. All right. So I tried not to repeat sketch types. But other than that, yeah, it was mostly like, you know, what do I think is, you know, most representative of the different kinds of things they would do? And then just how hard does it make me laugh? Yeah. So with that, why don't we get into it? So, Rich, you're number 10.
Number 10 is from the last series, the fourth and final series, called Woody and Tinny Words.
Intercourse.
Later, dear.
No, the word intercourse. Good and Woody. Intercourse. Pert, pert thighs. Botty, botty, botty. Erogenous zone. Oh, concubine. Erogenous zone. Loose woman. Erogenous zone. Oh, thank you, dear. There's a funny thing, dear. All the naughty words sound woody.
Really, dear? How about tit?
Oh, dear. I hadn't thought about that.
Tit, tit.
Oh, that's very tinny, isn't it? Tit, tit. Oh, tinny, tinny, tinny. Oh, dear. Ocelot. Wasp.
It is this erudite group of, like, it's like, who's on the left? It's Graham Chapman on the left, and there's a woman in the middle, and then I believe it's Eric Idle as a woman on the right. And it's just, they're just, there's all these servants behind them just standing there, never saying a thing, never moving. And he starts talking about the difference between words that have a woody sound versus words that have a tinny sound. And the woman in between them, anytime she hears the word tinny, she freaks out and eventually runs out and runs back in. And they just keep repeating these long, weird words. Like, that's very woody. No, that's very tinny. And it's really dumb and it makes me laugh.
I'll admit, I cannot call that one to mind. It's been a long time since I've watched. I didn't watch everything all the way through. I did. Yeah. You know, I tried to go with like what sticks in my memory from having seen it. So now I'm really curious to go check that one out because, I mean, spoiler alert, they don't have very many bad sketches. They're all, you know, very, very silly and weird. So, you know, it'll be fun to, when I go back to edit this and find the clip of that scene.
Nice.
Ned, any thoughts on this one? I saw you nodding that you weren't sure about this one either.
Oh, no, I was just, I have never seen that one. Or I mean, I have, because invariably I have watched all of them at some point. But again, I'm almost 45. Not everything sticks in my brain.
Same.
So great.
Yeah. All right, Ned, you're number 10.
Okay, so I just wrote out 10. I didn't actually quantify them. So I'm just going to pick these at random.
How
so my number
Python
10 would be... yeah. I'm going to go with the spam, the infamous spam.
Sure.
Have you got anything without spam?
Well, the spam egg, sausage and spam, that's not got much spam in it.
I don't want any spam.
Why can't she have egg, bacon, spam and sausage?
That's got spam in it.
Hasn't got as much spam in it as spam, egg, sausage and spam, has it?
Could you do me egg, bacon, spam and sausage without the spam then?
Yeah.
What do you mean, yeah? I don't like spam.
Spam, 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 spam,
spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam.
I don't like spam!
Shh, dear, don't cause a fuss. I'll have your spam. I love it. I'm having spam, 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 baked beans, spam, 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 and spam.
Spam, 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 spam,
spam. Baked beans are off.
Well, could I have her spam instead of the baked beans, then?
You mean spam, 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 and spam?
Lovely spam, wonderful spam, wonderful spam, wonderful spam, wonderful spam, wonderful spam, spam, spam.
I mean, there's a lot of aspects. It stuck with me just because as a child, spam is funny.
Sure.
But then as I got older and started traveling the world more, I feel like I've been into these little cafes where I'm just like, you don't have a very diverse menu, do you? This is just a lot of the same lone ingredient there. But for me, what really stands out about it is the randomness of the Vikings.
Yeah.
Popping up. Singing the spam song, and it's that to me, I put it on the list because it was so quintessentially Monty Python for me that it's just like, okay, we've got this thing that's clearly about this thing, we need a jingle. Vikings? Yeah, that's right. Right, Vikings. Let's do Vikings.
Ruddy Vikings.
Yeah, Terry Jones in the back just yelling,
spam, spam, egg, bacon, and spam.
You know, perfect delivery.
Yeah. And this sketch features, they're not quite the Pepper Potts, which were the, when they would dress up as women, specifically old ladies, and they would call these characters, they're like called Pepper Potts in the script. And this is all, they would all do these from time to time. They're like, oh yes, you know, that voice. Easily one of their most famous sketches. And probably the reason I avoided eating spam for most of my life until relatively recently. I was like, all right, I guess I'll finally try this stuff. How bad could it really be? It's all right. It's better than you think it is. Yeah. My son loves this sketch.
Sure.
He is almost 5 years old. He'll be five by the time this comes out. And yeah, I played this one for him. And he thought it was just really funny. Which is about probably the same age. This was one of the ones my dad had on 8-track. That's probably the same age I was when I heard it the first time.
Nice.
So, all right. My number 10. My number 10. You know, there's so many sketches to choose from, but why is it that no one remembers the sketch about Johann Gambleputty, Devon Osfern, Splendid Slitz, Kresken, Bon Fry, Digger Dangle, Dongle, Dungle, Burstein, Von Nackerthrasher, Applebanger, Horderwitz, Tickle Lenz, Granny Not Spell Tickle, Grandlish, Grummeyer, Spotsbots, Kurslitz, Heimbleisen, Gutenbahn, Bahnwagen, Beat Ein Nürnberger, Brat vs. Gespritz, Mitch Wiemacher, Hunsfoot, Gunbur, Rabbishone, Dr. Kaufseis, Mittler, Ralke von Hopkoft of Orange.
We start with an interview with his only surviving relative, Karl Gambleputty. Devon,
I first met Johann Gambleputty, Devon Ausman, Spladen, Slit, Crash, Quinbon, Freidiger, Dingle, Dongle, Dangle, Doom, Burstein, Von Nackerthrasher, Happerbanger, Horowitz, Tickle, and Sick, Grandinotti, Spell, Tinkle, Grandly, Grumblemeyer, Spell, Tawassa, Kirsten, Imbolheisen, Barton, Bargain, Gutter, Carbon, Bitter, in Ernberg, Bratwurst, Gesperden, Dry Macleod, Hensford, Gruber, Habershirt, Deck, Carbsflesh, Mittelwaucher von Kaufkopf, Ovel, when he was with his wife, Sarah, Gambleputty.
Yes, if I may just cut in on you there, Herr Gamblepotted of an Ausfern, Spaden, Schlittkreis, Klingerbahn, Burstein, Blackerfrasche, Applebanger, Tickelenzi, Grande, Notti, Speltinko, Grandlich, Grumbelmar, Spelter, Wasserkurs, Lickimbel, Eisenbahn, Wagen, Guten Abend, bitte ein Nürnberger, Bratwurst, gesperrt mit Zwiemach, Lube, Hunsfurt, Gumbe, aber schönen Danke, Kalbfleisch, Mittelwache, Bonhauptkopf, Verwulm.
Gesundheit? I don't know. I think that was impressive.
For the record, I did that for memory. Wow. It's not, just to prove it, it just says Johann Gamblepotted on the paper. I didn't write the whole thing down. So you can tell why this is on here. I forced myself. I invested the time in eighth grade to memorize that, and I never forgot it. And I picked this because there are many sketches, as we sort of alluded to, that like involve these feats of memorization and regurgitation. And I thought this one, I mean, because yes, I have the emotional connection that I bothered to memorize this. And again, I do this for my kids. They think it's funny to do that. But the basic premise of the sketch is, you know, hey, the joke is this guy has this crazy long name and they have to keep repeating it throughout the sketch because it's like a show about the arts. And this guy is supposedly some famous composer. And every time they talk about him, they have to say the whole thing. At which point they then go interview like his last remaining relative who's 1,000 years old and then like literally dies having to say the name twice. The best part about it for me is then, so the interview part with the relative is taking place in like a garden or some natural setting. So after this guy keels over dead, as John Cleese is trying to interview him, Cleese walks out of frame and then just walks back in with a shovel and just starts digging. And like, to me, that's the best part of this sketch, which is like, yes, it's funny that this name is so long, but I love this little joke at the end that like, yeah, he brought a shovel just in case. He's got one ready to go in case someone dies. He's just going to bury this dude in his garden. It's so yes. Johann Gamblepotty.
Nice. Well done. There's just fair warning. There is no time that I will do anything near that impressive this episode.
impressive.
Also fair warning. I rewatched all of these episodes like 40 minutes ago, and I can't remember that much of any of them.
My brain is just
established, there's a nationwide ADHD medication shortage, and it's deeply affecting some of us.
Like I said, this is when, you know, when I was 13, I had the time and the inclination to force that into my memory, and for whatever reason, it never left. It will infuriate my wife that I cannot remember useful things, but this kind of stuff.
I get it.
Yeah. It's in there.
13, I can still sing We Didn't Start the Fire because of when I was 13. That was my memorization. I'm like, I should do this for a talent show. And my mom's like, please don't. Please do not do this.
All right. Rich, you're number 9.
This may be on either one of your lists. I don't know, but it's pretty fairly famous one. Hungarian phrase book.
I will not buy this record. It is scratched.
Sorry?
I will not buy this record. It is scratched.
No, this tobacconist's.
I will not buy this tobacconist's. It is scratched.
No, tobacco, cigarettes.
Yeah, cigarettes, my hovercraft is full of eels.
What?
My hovercraft. Is full of eels.
Matches. Huh?
Yeah. Do you want to come back to my place? Bouncy.
I don't think you're using that right.
You great poof.
Let me 6 and 6, please.
If I said you had a beautiful body, would you hold it against me? I am no longer infected.
No. Here we are. Yandela Vasa Gdenwi Stravenka.
Oh, I love this one. I forgot to put this on there. What a great choice.
Yeah, John Cleese does, and by the way, I saw a talk back with John Cleese like about 7 or 8 years ago, and he made a very hard point to be like, it's not Cleese, it's Cleese, like cheese, but Cleese. It's stuck in my head to call him that. Anyway, John Cleese does this. I don't know what a Hungarian accent is supposed to sound like, but whatever he does is great and funny. And, you know, he says it with such sincerity, these, like, horrible, you know, things. And then they put the guy on trial for making the phrase book. And, I mean, it just, you know, they heighten it and heighten it, and it just goes nuts.
Yeah, the joke is, of course, that the Hungarian phrase book is mistranslating things.
Yeah.
So that when he goes to say something like, I want to buy some cigarettes, what he says in English is, you know, offensive.
Yeah.
And yeah, just what a great simple premise, because they just play it for until eventually the other guy pulls out the phrase book to try. OK, it's not working. Let me say something to him in Hungarian.
Yeah.
And then when whatever he says, Cleese hauls off and just punches him
right in the face. Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic sketch.
Yeah. Now, do you remember that one or?
Oh, yeah. Like I said, since I didn't put an order, it is on my list. So I'm going to call that my number 9 as well.
Fair enough.
Right. It honestly is. It is that kind of stuff. But it's like, it's the whole thing they do of like, just when you think the sketch has ended, it clearly has not ended. And they are just going to keep layering things on top of it. Because like Rich said, it's like, oh, he punched him. Ha ha, that's the end of their sketch. Nope. Now we have a policeman coming. Okay, the policeman's going to arrest him. That's the end of that sketch. Nope. Now we're in a courtroom.
Yeah.
And it just keeps going and going. But it flows together so naturally. Plus, just I want some matches being my hovercraft is full of eels is just one of the funniest things ever.
Yeah. I mean, again, infinitely quotable stuff here. This is one of their more, as you said, it flows in a weird way, but it is more structured like a conventional sketch. Grading on a curve.
Yeah. Yeah, the premise is very like, oh, you could see a different sketch group doing at least the first part of this sketch. Maybe not the rest of it, but yeah.
Right. So I'll go quick. My number 9 is Spam. Emotional favorite. Again, like I said, I've heard that this was on that list of stuff I heard when I was young and stuck with me forever. And influential in that the reason that your email junk folder is called Spam is because of this sketch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Lasting impact from Monty Python on the world of nerddom and coding. All right. So Rich, your number 8.
Well, my number 8 is Spam, but I do have one thing to say that we haven't said yet, which is there's a point, because it's from the same episode as Hungarian Phrasebook, and there's a point in the end where John Cleese comes out as the Hungarian and then gets arrested. So there's actually a callback in this sketch from my number 8 to my number 9.
Yeah, and there's different versions of these sketches, too, because some of them were recorded. So, like, the recording that I heard on the Dr. Demento show was one of the recordings they made for, like, an album they released. Yep. So it doesn't have, like, the laugh track. It's, you know, slightly different, and it doesn't end quite the same way in the recording that it does in the Flying Circus episode. So there are some slight variations on these. They also released a quote-unquote movie called And Now for Something Completely Different, which they redid a bunch of their sketches and released it as a movie. But again, I don't know if there's a laugh track for that or not. But
I don't believe there is.
Yeah, but it is still excellent. I mean, it's great material. And some of it, on a handful of occasions, I think they fine-tuned some of these sketches to make them better. I can't remember if Spam is one of them, but
I know one of the big changes between some of the later release stuff, the album stuff, and the movie is you can tell when they were censored by the... okay, that's great.
I just got that Amber Alert. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. We all got an Amber Alert. It's on the recording. So
great.
if you're hearing this like a month and a half from now when I release it, be on the lookout for a white Chrysler or whatever. Yeah. go ahead.
No, but there was a lot of like the whole BBC watershed time slots where they had to censor certain words. So you'll see in certain sketches, they'll just yell, oh, excrement, oh, fornication, or whatever. And it was something that had been censored that they were like, now we're going to say what we wanted to. I'm like, it was kind of funnier when you said fornication.
Yeah, I tend to actually agree with that. I think sometimes the censored thing can be funnier than the real thing.
Yeah.
All right, so Ned, you're number 8.
Okay, my number 8's going to be the funniest joke in the world.
Oh! was obvious, the joke was lethal. No one could read it and live. Scribbler's mother, alarmed by the unusual sounds of merriment, entered the room and found what was apparently a suicide note.
The war against the Hun continues, and as Britain's brave boys battle against the Boche, their leaders are on the lookout for new breakthroughs that could provide the ultimate weapon in the war against the Hun. And here, in this little house in Finchley, they think maybe they've found it. It's a joke so deadly, it could have Fritz's forces falling about.
The killer joke?
It's the killer joke, which ended up killing the writer immediately after he wrote it, but it was the escalation of that one that amused me so much. And that one, it's like, yeah, I definitely find the sketch funny, but this one holds sentimental value for me purely because I took German in high school because I didn't want to be popular. And
same, I took French.
Well, the French kids got to go to France. The Ooh. German kids had the option to go to France with the French students. But we were in class one day and the teacher just sort of run out of stuff to teach. And he's like, I don't know. And I happened to have a VHS that I taped off the TV of Monty Python that had that sketch in it. And I was like, oh, I got a tape. We could watch it. And he's like, yeah, but no, I mean, does it have anything to do with German? And I'm like, no, yes, yes. Fast forward to 9 minutes in, watch this. And it was just like, you know, it's that Ned saves the day because we don't have to do class because everyone's watching Monty Python because of one joke. Nice. So that's why I put it on the list, just because good times, good memories.
Yeah. And it's a great sketch. It's in my honorable mentions. The premise for people who haven't seen it is, yeah, this guy writes a joke that's so funny that if you hear it or read it in its entirety, you will laugh yourself to death. So it becomes a weapon to be used in World War II against the Nazis. There's so many funny bits in the way they escalated. Like, you know, they have to translate it into German, but they don't want people to die, so they can only translate like, you know, a word or two at a time of this joke. And then they get like the Germans have to have their own, you know, version of the joke. And the joke is just my dog has no nose. How does he smell? Badly.
How does he smell?
Delivered in German though, like it with subtitles. Like it's really unfunny.
Yeah.
Which how badly did you want to hear whatever the joke was?
Oh, yes, but then again, I mean, like, as a kid, obviously, badly. But, you know, now as I'm older, I'm like, no, I get it. I get the humor. It's, you know, don't show the ghost. Don't show the monster because it's not nearly as scary as what's in our mind. So,
yeah,
right.
And to me, it's the equivalent of, like you mentioned Douglas Adams earlier, like, you know, 42, but we forgot the question. Like, yeah, as a kid, I was like, well, I want to know the question. But as an adult, I'm like, I never want to know the question. Like, that's not funny if we ever know it.
Right. My number eight is another one I heard off an 8-track tape when I was a kid and did not understand. this is sort of, I'm merging this with two things because when you hear the recording of this, there was a song at the end. That song is not in the original airing of the Monty Python Flying Circus TV show, but that is the Bruce's Philosopher's sketch.
Australia, nice. Australia, we love you. Amen.
Another tune.
Matty Christian.
Dear Bruce, are you a poofter?
Are you a poofter?
No.
Now, right, I just want to remind you of the faculty rules. Rule one.
No poofters.
Rule two. No member of the faculty is to maltreat the abbos in any way at all. If there's anybody watching. Rule three.
No poofters.
Rule four. Now, this term, I don't want to catch anybody not drinking. Rule five.
No poofters.
Rule six. There is no... Rule six, rule seven.
No poofters.
Right, that concludes the reading of the rules. Bruce.
This is the wattle, the emblem of our land. You can stick it in a bottle, you can hold it in your hand.
Amen.
Emmanuel.
your camp was a real piss and was very rarely stable. I digger was a boozy beggar if you think you under the table. David Hume could out-consume Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, and Wittgenstein was a beery swine who's just a slosh to Schlegel. There's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanently pissed. John Stuart Mill, of his own free will, on half a pint of shandy was particularly ill. Plato, they say, could stick it away. Half a grain of whiskey every day. Aristotle was a bugger for the bottle. Hobbes was fond of his dram. And René Descartes was a drunken fart. I drink, therefore I am.
This is a very weird sketch of, it's like a series of like comically Australian philosophy professors who are welcoming a new professor into their group from Britain. Everyone in the group is named Bruce. It makes no sense. Mm-hmm. It's like, it feels like they're hitting on Australian stereotypes, except they're not actual Australian types. They're like stereotypes. Like none of it. It's like, I guess Australians are like that. Nope. It's like fictional stereotypes of Australians, except maybe for their love of drink. But the song at the end is just this incredibly impressive, like string of like jokes about different philosophers and how drunk they would get. You know, René Descartes was a drunken fart. I drink, therefore I am, that kind of stuff. Mm. It's like stupid and again, very like lofty and erudite at the same time. So yeah, I like this one.
Nice. This is one I don't really remember, honestly, so I can't speak much to it.
The funny thing is I know the sketch and I know the song, and it wasn't until I was right now years old that I realized they were connected to each other. Because a friend of mine used to sing that song when we were in grade school, and I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I remember the Bruce sketch, but not. I just did a visual thing on a podcast. I'm smart.
Are you a poofta? Roll six. No,
Australia.
We love you. Amen. I believe when you want, I was surprised because I actually went back and watched this one.
Right.
And the song isn't there. The song was something they released on one of their albums, but they do flow into each other directly. So I was like, oh, weird. I was sitting there waiting, like, oh, now they're going to get to that hilarious song. And I'm like, oh, it's not, they're not doing it. There's a lot of stuff like that, that like only appears in a handful of like certain pockets of things they released. So,
yes.
All right. So then we're on to number seven, Rich.
Sam Peckinpah's Salad Days. Yes.
Hello, everybody. Hello. I say, what a simply super day.
Gosh, yes.
It's so, you know, sunny.
Yes, isn't it? I say, anyone for tennis? Oh, super. What fun. I say, Lionel, catch.
What a simply super day, you know, that line. And then it's one of those, again, there's just death, and this is specifically dismemberment and a comical amount of flowing red blood. It's basically starts out like it's going to be some, you know, send up of like a 1800s, like we're all in the park outside, and then someone throws him a tennis ball, he starts bleeding. Then someone else gets dismembered, and it's just blood, 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 blood. And then it cuts to the guy hosting the, not even in the movie, hosting the movie, and he gets shot, and blood, blood, blood. And then it scrolls through and has text with the BBC apologizing, and then an additional BBC text apologizing for the previous apology.
Ned, any thoughts on Salad Days?
Well, I don't remember that, but I love seeing or hearing those moments where you see something, you're like, okay, I see where that inspired something later, because the apology for the apology was a convention they brought back for Holy Grail. Yeah. with the captions in the beginning.
Yeah, this one is so this is one of their rare things that is actually like a spoof of something that's like tied to the world we actually live in, because like when I was a kid, I didn't know who Sam Peckinpah was. Like, I just thought that was a funny like Monty Python name.
Is that a real person?
Oh no, he was a director. He was a movie director that was known for making, you know, he had like the reputation that like a Quentin Tarantino has, that like he made these films that were considered very violent by the standards of the late 60s.
Yeah. Wow.
And so the joke was
like Jim Jarmusch.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. So the joke was like this movie Salad Days starts out, as you said, it's a bunch of like foppish people in straw boater hats in a field. Like, I say, anyone for tennis? And then it turns into an impossibly cartoonish level of violence. So it was meant to spoof this real life director. Which is why it ends in like the announcer or the host or whatever dying in a hail of bullets. Wow. But as you sort of mentioned, Rich, in a way, the sketch is almost funnier if you don't know who Sam Peckinpah is. It works either way, but yeah, this one is this is belly laugh level of like stupid violence. Yeah. Yeah. Because like one of the jokes is like this: there's a guy out in the field with an upright piano. You know, why would you push a piano out into a grassy field? I don't know. But like one of the guys, as he's like bleeding and like stumbling, closes the lid. And somehow that chops off the hands of John Cleese, who is playing the piano, and then just fountains of blood out of his stumps. Like, it's really something. Yeah. And it's only like a minute and a half long.
Yeah.
I do remember this one now.
Yeah.
I remember this one very vividly now.
The blood is coming back to you?
Yeah. I think they were playing like badminton or tennis at some point.
That's how it starts. It's like, who's up for tennis? Yeah, yeah. And the guy throws him a tennis ball.
It hits him in the eye, and then fountains of blood.
Yeah.
All right, Ned, you're number seven, please.
All right, I'm gonna knock out one of the other heavy hitter ones here, because I want to, like, the other ones. You know, they have those classic sketches that just like everyone knows, everyone loves, and the biggest, most famous one of their iconic sketches that I loved was the cheese shop sketch.
Camembert, perhaps.
Ah, we have camembert, yes, sir.
You do?
Excellent. Yes, sir. It's a bit runny.
Oh, I like it runny.
Well, it's very runny, actually.
No matter. Fetch hither le fromage de la Belle France. Mm.
I think it's a bit runnier than you'll like it, sir.
I don't care how fucking runny it is. Hand it over with all speed.
Oh!
What now?
The cat's eaten it. Has it? Cheetah.
Gouda?
No.
Edam?
No.
Caithness?
No.
Smoked Austrian?
No.
Japanese Sage Derby?
No, sir.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Of course, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir.
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
Wednesday dough?
Yes.
Ah, well, I'll have some of that.
Oh, I thought you were talking to me, sir. Mr. Wednesday dough, that's my name.
Greek feta?
Not as such.
Gorgonzola,
no.
Parmesan,
no.
Mozzarella, pickle crema, Danish bimbo,
no.
Czech sheep's milk,
no.
Venezuelan beaver cheese.
Not today, sir, no.
Ah, how about cheddar?
Well, we don't have much corporate around here, sir.
Not much it's the single most popular cheese in the world.
Not around here, sir.
And what is the most popular cheese round here?
Rochester, sir.
Is it?
Oh, yes, sir. Staggeringly popular in this manner.
Is it?
It's our number one bestseller, sir.
I see. Ilchester, eh?
Right, sir.
All right. Okay. Have you got any? He asked, expecting the answer now.
I'll have a look, sir.
It's not much of a cheese shop, is it?
Finest in the district.
Explain the logic underlying that conclusion, okay?
Well, it's so cheesy, sir.
It's certainly uncontaminated by cheese.
You haven't asked me about limbo, have
you? Is it worth it? Have you shut that bloody bazooki up?
Told you so.
Have you got any Limburger?
No.
That figures.
You were talking about the quintessential man goes into a shop, doesn't get what he wants.
Yeah.
And that one is one of those ones that, like I said, I love it because it's just funny as all get out. And just the ending of it. But talking about my kind of love for John Cleese and that memorization, watching him go through every single one of those cheeses.
Yeah.
And having every single one of them with a different inflection, possibly a different accent. I mean, it was just, it's incredible seeing that and going, this is what I want to do. Why would I want to sit and, you know, some of these boring sketches where the guy goes, dogs? Yeah, dogs. I, that's not a real sketch from anything that I know of. But yeah. But the point being, it's like, that's so simple. And what they've done is so complex. And I guess for those who don't know, the guy goes into a cheese shop is... because he's hungry or a bit peckish, I believe, is his phrasing, and tries to get some cheese from a cheese shop, only to find out that it's completely devoid of cheese within the shop. And how does he solve the problem at the end? He shoots him in the face.
But, yes.
I had this one on a CD as well as having seen the episode. And I listened to the CD a lot more than I'd watched the episode.
Yeah.
And so... it was just kind of one of those little things where I'm like, that's not what he says. That's one. It's a bazooki in the recording, but it's something else here. What's going on? So it's just, I love those little, because that's not a censorship issue. That's just them being them.
Yeah.
Yeah. What, he's not just trying to buy cheese. Like, he's going through different types of cheese, just asking, do you have this? Yeah. Do you have that? Venezuelan beaver cheese?
Yes.
As he kind of like goes down this ridiculous list. And then, yeah, he like gets, you know, he asks about cheddar and like, it's the most popular cheese in the world, you know, which.
Wensleydale. Yes, sir.
Yeah. This is.
Oh, sorry. That's my last name. Wensleydale.
Yeah. It's impressive because it's one of the, again, it's all in the performance because on paper, just this guy absolutely. Guessing different cheeses and hearing the word no over and over again shouldn't be funny. You know, when you see it written out, but it's something about the way Cleese, as you said, Rich, like infuses the guessing with musicality. You have that bizarre element of, again, yeah, these guys playing like Greek music and dancing in the background for no obvious reason.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, and then the bluntness of him just shooting the guy in the face at the end is a great like cherry on top for the sketch.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just love how the calmness of Cleese when he's like, Do you have any cheese at all? Yes, sir. I'm going to ask you again. And if you say no, I'm going to shoot you.
Understand, if you say no,
and
do you have any cheese? No.
Yeah. And as a running thing,
what a tragic
we mentioned
waste
it already,
of human life.
It's just this idea that I heard it more on the Complete Ripoff CD, which was, I believe, one that they recorded live. I can't remember. But anyway, whatever that version was, that's the one. And I think, Ned, you and I, probably the same one, because it's like, oh, yeah, he said Bazooki didn't say the dancing and this and the other. And so it is, it's like hearing your favorite song, but like the live version, and it's like a little different. It's like, okay, that's the song, but I kind of like this other version better.
Yeah, this sketch also has something which I think is the first time, as far as I know, it's the first instance of this joke construction, which is, you know, do you have whatever cheese it is? He said, he asked expecting the answer no.
Yes.
Oh, I feel like I've heard people do that. But like, you know, he said expecting, you know, something like that. I feel like this is the first, those are all callbacks to this.
Nice.
Jumping into the third person randomly. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. My number seven, I wanted to go to do something that represented that really stupid side to show that, like, yes, they do a lot of very, you know, highbrow stuff, but sometimes they'll do something that's really just fucking dumb and also hilarious. So I went with Gumby Brain Specialist.
Okay. My brain hurts! Well, let's take a look at it, Mr. Gumby! No, no, no! My brain in my head! Oh! Huh? It'll have to come out! Out of my head! Yes! All the bits of it! Ooh. Nurse! 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 Nurse, take Mr. Gumby to a brain surgeon!
Yes, Doctor.
Where's the Lancet?
He's brilliant, you know.
Where's the bloody Lancet? My brain hurts too.
Glasses. Moustache.
Handkerchief.
We haven't talked about the Gumbies, which are, they don't have too many recurring characters, but this is like, it's not even a character. It's almost like a species that they do, kind of like the Pepper Potts, but it's just, it's them in like a sweater vest and some rolled up shorts with this knotted handkerchief on their head and like a little almost Hitler mustache and glasses. Mm-hmm. And the second, and as long as you see a character, don't talk like this, like literally as stupid as sounding as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. And the bit of the sketch is, you know, Gumby, they're all named Gumby, goes into a doctor's office, tells the doctor, my brain hurts, it'll have to come out. And so they talk about doing brain surgery. But my favorite bit within all of this tomfoolery is he's there on the table for the brain surgery, and the brain surgeon is Graham Chapman, and he's speaking normally. That's, you know, scalpel, you know, whatever, this, that. And then he says, like, glasses, mustache, handkerchief, as he puts on the, and the second he puts on the handkerchief and becomes one of them, his voice turns into the Gumby voice. And like, unbelievably stupid, but again, like, I've rarely laughed at something that hard.
There's something about that big, dumb voice that, like, you know, there's the American big, dumb voice, but then the British big, dumb voice. There's something funnier about that than, like, any other accent that I know of for a big, dumb voice.
Ned, any thoughts on the Gumbies, or are you?
Oh, no, I agree. It sounds very Birmingham to me. That's what I always kind of thought was so funny about it, because there's a whole, like, oddly enough, I found the British city of Birmingham and the American Arkansas city of Birmingham have similar voices to each other. And it is a kind of big, my brain has a big B sound. So, yeah, that particular sketch didn't resonate with me until I moved to London, and then I started meeting people that actually did kind of talk like that, and you're like, oh, you're real. You're real. It's like the opposite of, like, what I learned about Santa Claus.
Apparently, the Gumby character was based on them watching news broadcast, and they would do these man on the street interviews, and they were just like, man, the average man on the street is so fucking dumb. And so that's where it came from. It's like, let's just make the dumbest man on the street possible. Nice. All right, Rich, you're number six.
We already talked about it. The funniest joke in the world. It's from the very first episode of the very first season. And, you know, I think it's so emblematic of the heightening that we've already talked about and the absurdity, playing it super, super serious the whole time. And, I mean, they ended it with literal footage of Hitler, not like them dressed as Hitler, like actual old school film footage of Hitler. I'm like, that is ballsy on your first episode.
I didn't realize it was the very first episode. What a great sketch. Like, them coming fully formed, kind of, these are, you know, five guys that all come from Cambridge and Oxford and stuff, and they were doing sketch comedy there. And, like, you can feel that, like, education and that lived-in World War II experience in this sketch and a lot of their sketches.
Yeah.
All right, Ned, you're number six.
That would be the summarizing Proust competition.
Remember, each contestant this evening has a maximum of 15 seconds to summarize A la Recherche du Temps Perdu, and only Proust over here, you can see exactly how far he gets. So let's crack straight on with our first contestant tonight. He's last year's semi-finalist from Luton, Mr. Harry Bennett. Hello, Harry. Now, there's the summarizing spot. You're on the summarising spot. 15 seconds from now.
Proust's novel ostensibly tells it of the irrevocability of time lost, the forfeiture of innocence through experience, the reinstallment of extratemporal values of time regained. Ultimately, the novel is both optimistic and set within the context of a humane religious experience, restating as it does the concept of intemporality. In the first volume, Swan, the family friend...
Well tried, Harry.
But unfortunately, he chose a general appraisal of the work before getting onto the story. And as you can see, he only got as far as page one of Swan's Way, the first of the seven volumes. A good try, though, and very nice posture.
Harry Baggett, you're from Luton?
Yes, Arthur, yes.
Now, Harry, what made you first want to try and start summarising Proust?
Well, I first entered a seaside summarising Proust competition when I was on holiday in Bournemouth, and my doctor encouraged me with it.
And, Harry, what are your hobbies outside summarising?
Well, strangling animals, golf and masturbating.
This one, I can't even explain. But we talked about that, how you can be so dumb and so intelligent at the same time. So the premise of the sketch is people are brought into this game show competition, and they have 15 seconds to summarize all of Proust's works. Graham Chapman starts out, and he's rapid firing, and he's just trying to get it. No, I'm sorry, you did well, but you only got through the end of his first novel. There were still six more to go. The second guy, Michael Palin, he comes out. He's trying to summarize Proust, and he's like, "There was a man. Yes, there was a man. There was a man, and there was a woman as well. And okay, and your time's up." But he somehow had summarized the first three of Proust's works. Then they bring out a choir to start singing, and since nobody won, the presenter decides that the award goes to the woman with the biggest breast. So he just pulls out of the side. I'm just like, "What is happening?" They take such a highbrow concept and just completely twist your expectations of it. And that's why it's up there for me. It's very short, and I don't know how rewatchable it is, but it stuck with me forever.
This reminds me, I have this one of my honorable mentions, which is the novel writing sketch, which is, oh God, who wrote Tess of the D'Urbervilles? Thomas Hardy.
Yes.
The joke is that Thomas Hardy is there to write his next novel, but you're watching him write the novel. You're hearing these two guys describe what he's writing like it was a sporting event. You know, like, oh, and this, he's writing a letter. It's T-H. Oh, it could be the. He's written several novels starting with that article. And yeah, it's just them talking as fast as they can, trying to describe that. That feels like of a piece of like, let's talk about, you know, again, like highfalutin literature, but find a way to make it really kind of accessible and stupid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
My number six is Four Yorkshiremen.
House. We're looking to live in a house. We used to live in one room, all 26 of us. No furniture. Half the floor was missing, and we were all huddled together in one corner for fear of falling.
Yeah, you were lucky to have a room. We used to have to live in corridor.
Oh, we used to dream of living in a corridor. Would have been a palace to us. We used to live in an old water tank and a rubbish tip. We got woke up every morning by having a load of rotting fish dumped all over us. House.
When I say house, it was only a hole in the ground covered by a sheet of tarpaulin. But it was a house to us.
We were evicted from our hole in the ground. We had to go and live in a lake.
You were lucky to have a lake. There were 150 of us living in shoebox in middle of the road.
Cardboard box?
No.
You were lucky. We lived for 3 months in a paper bag in a septic tank. You just have to get up at 6 in the morning, clean the paper bag, eat a crust of stale bread, go to work down mill, 14 hours a day, week in, week out, for 6 months a week. And when we got home, our dad would thrash us to sleep with his belt. Luxury.
Which is a sketch that does not appear in the TV show. I believe it's only on some of their albums. And it's basically their version of the classic When I Was Your Age concept. It's just these four guys, you know, essentially competing by talking about how awful their childhoods were. You know, I walked uphill to school both ways in the snow. But yeah, the level it gets to like, you know, there were 16 of us living in a shoebox in the middle of the road. They keep escalating it. And every time one of them says like, you know, their awful childhood, the others just goes like luxury and then proceeds to describe something worse. And this is one of the few sketches that does have a button because at the end he goes, and if you try to tell the young people that today, they won't believe you.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love this one.
I love this sketch too. I didn't put it on my list because I assumed it came from Flying Circus, and then it listed something called At Last, the 1948 show. I don't know what that was or is. And I knew it was on the albums later, but yeah, this is like a very traditional sketch in many ways. Of course, it goes heightened to absurd, but I mean, it makes me laugh every time.
Ned, any thoughts on Four Yorkshiremen before we move on?
I don't know it.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm going to go find it.
Oh, you will enjoy this. Yeah.
It's fun.
All right,
I'm
then
keeping
Rich...
tallies of the ones that I'm like, don't remember.
All right, Rich, number five.
No one said this yet. I don't know if it's coming up in other people's lists, but self-defense against fresh fruit.
Oh, we want to learn how to defend ourselves against pointed sticks, do we? Getting all iron mighty, eh? Fresh fruit not good enough for you, eh? Oh, well, I'll tell you something, my lad. When you're walking home tonight and some homicidal maniac comes after you with a bunch of loganberries, don't come cry to me! Right, the passion fruit! When your assailant lunges at you with the passion fruit, thus...
We've done the passion fruit!
What?
We've done the passion fruit!
We've done oranges, apples, grapefruits...
Whole and segments.
Pomegranates, greengages...
Grapes, passion fruits...
Lemons...
Plums...
Yeah, and mangoes in syrup.
How about cherries?
We done that then.
Red and black?
Yes.
All right then. Bananas! Oh. We haven't done them, have we? Oh. Right, bananas! How do you defend yourself against a man armed with a banana? Yeah, you, take this. Now, it's quite simple to defend yourself against the banana fiend. First of all, you force him to drop the banana. Next, you eat the banana, thus disarming him. You have now rendered him helpless.
Suppose he's got a bunch.
Shut up!
Supposing he's got a pointed stick.
Shut up! Right, now, you, Mr. Apricot.
Harrison.
Mr. Harrison, come with me with that banana, then. Come on, attack me with it, as hard as you like. Come on. No. Put something into it, for God's sake. Hold it like that. Scream. Now, come on. Come on, attack me. Come on. Yeah. Come on. Yeah. No. Now I eat the banana.
It is. There is no redeeming intelligence in this sketch whatsoever. It is pure. I don't know how John Cleese had a voice after this sketch, because he gives it this loud, voluminous character who's like the self-defense instructor, and it's all five of them. So he's got four students. And he's like, today we're going to learn how to defend ourselves against fruit. And they're like, we do that every time. And they list all these fruits. And he goes, we haven't done banana. And one of them comes with banana and he just shoots him. And it's like, okay, yeah, that works. And then he gives another guy raspberry. And he's like, you're going to shoot me. No, I won't. And all right. So he comes and he drops a 16-ton weight, comically large weight, you know, on him. And then, right. You know, it's just... It's so stupid, and he just murders these four guys. When the last two with a tiger, that's as fake as you could possibly make a tiger look, because of course they're not going to get a real tiger for their show. But you know, it's just dumb. But I gotta say, Cleese's friggin' tenacity to play this loud character for, it's kind of a longer sketch, like 5-6 minutes, and just never relentless, and even ends with him just talking to himself for like 30 seconds.
This is on my honorable mentions. It kept going on and off my list as I debated whether to include it. It is fantastic. I love this one. One of my favorite like subtle jokes in it is, you know, so he shoots the guy, right? Just shoots him dead. And the other student goes like, you killed him. And Cleese goes like, well, he came at me with a banana. Like,
yeah,
of course I shot him. He's trying to kill me. Like, it's a class. It's a classroom environment. Like I, very funny sketch. And again, all on the back of everyone in it playing it deadly serious, especially John Cleese.
Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely.
So good.
Great choice. Ned, any thoughts from you on Fresh Fruit?
Well, I mean, this one hung around my honorable mentions too, and I wanted to put it on there because it had inspired a sketch that I shot. Oh, geez, 18 years ago at this point. I just decided not to, because it, like other things, like I said, spent more time popping back up. Such a good sketch. It's like, now that the minute it came up just now, because I was avoiding looking at other people's top 10 lists, because there's, you talk about Monty Python sketches, there's like bukus of lists on the internet of people, like everyone's got their list out. And I'm like, don't want to read them, don't want an influence. But once I had made my list and look, and this showed up, I'm like, why did I not put that on my...
What is on your list at number five?
Well, on my list at number five is Penguin on Top of the Telly.
Funny, that penguin being there, isn't it? What's he doing there?
Standing!
I can see that!
If it lays an egg, it will fall down the back of the television set.
You'll have to watch that. Unless it's a male.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Yes. Looks fairly butch.
Perhaps it comes from next door.
Penguins don't come from next door. They come from the Antarctic. Burma! Why'd you say Burma?
I'm panicked.
Oh. Perhaps it's from the zoo.
Which zoo?
How should I know which zoo? I'm not Dr. Bloody Brunofsky.
How does Dr. Brunofsky know which zoo it came from?
He knows everything.
Oh, I wouldn't like that. It'd take the mystery out of life. Anyway, if it came from the zoo, it'd have property of the zoo stamped on it.
No, it wouldn't. They don't stamp animals property of the zoo. You couldn't stamp a huge lion?
They stamp them when they're small.
What happens when they molt?
Lions don't molt!
No, but penguins do. They're run rings round you logically.
Oh, intercourse the penguin.
The exploding penguin, which I love for so many reasons. Sentimentally, it's because, like, we had a little end of year... you know, show in our theater department in high school, and my buddy and I did that sketch as our piece, having also recorded our own version of the Mary Queen of Scots audio that sort of led into it. But I love this sketch so much just because it's got such sharp, simple wit. Just like, what's on the telly? Oh, it's a penguin. No, I don't mean on top of the telly. I mean, what's on TV? What are we watching? Even though there's a penguin sitting on top of the television. But, like, even to this day, when I don't know what to say, I will occasionally shout Burma. Just because there's like, Burma! Why did you say Burma? I panicked. But I love that response.
Yeah. Panic.
We should ask Dr. What's his face? Oh, why would we ask him? What does he know about penguin? He knows everything.
Yeah.
But also, so I'm a huge fan of the Muppet Show as well. I was watching that from early childhood. Like, you know, that was like 2 or 3 year old. We weren't a Disney household. We were a Jim Henson household. But Jim Henson always said, if you don't know how to end a sketch, either have one character eat the other character. Or everything blows up. And this sketch is just the epitome of that. And it's definitely like, you know, Jim Henson was such a fan of the British comedies that, you know, there was like, he probably saw that and was like, oh, what a great way to end the scene. I'll just blow it up. Fantastic. Good. We can just move on. So that's why it makes my number five. Cause like, I just love it.
Yeah. This is a great sketch. It is on my honorable mentions. I don't even know how to describe this sketch. Other than it's two old ladies, as you said, kind of bickering about what to watch on TV. But, like, even conceptually, this thing is so weird. And as you said, that joke, we go, Burma! Why'd you say Burma? I panicked. Like, what does that have to do with anything?
See,
like,
we're
it
just
comes
still
out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it, like, apropos of nothing, she just spouts out the word Burma. Like, I didn't even know what Burma was the first time I saw it.
Yeah, me neither.
At one point, she's like, oh, if it lays an egg, it'll fall down the back of the television. Oh, we'll have to watch that. She just gets super excited about like, and it's also funny just because, like, seeing people of my parents' generations getting to that, you know, 80-plus age, and I'm like, you would just watch a penguin lay an egg and have it roll down the back of a TV. This is excitement for you. Got it. Wow.
Yeah. My number five is Salad Days. We've talked that one a lot, so I'll just go blow right past that and ask Rich for your number four.
I'm sure this will be on other people's Ministry of Silly Walks.
That's it, is it?
Yes, that's it, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's not particularly silly, is it? I mean, the right leg isn't silly at all, and the left leg merely does a forward aerial half turn every alternate step.
Yes, but I think with government backing, I could make it very silly.
Mr. Pewdie, the very real problem is one of money. I'm afraid that the Ministry of Freedom is no longer getting the kind of support that it needs. You see, there's defence, social security, health, housing, education, silly wars. They're all supposed to be but last year, the government spent less on the Ministry of Civil Defence than it did on national defence. Now, we get £348 million a year, which is supposed to be spent on all our available products. Coffee?
Yes, please.
Mrs. Two Lumps, would you bring us in two coffees, please?
Yes, Mr. Teabag.
Out of a mind. Now, the Japanese have a man who can bend his leg back over his head and back again with every single step, while the Israelis have that... Ah, oh, here's the coffee. Thank you, lovely.
It is the... You know, we talked about all the dialogue they have to say, which in a lot of sketches, they have to say a lot of dialogue. But in this sketch, more than one, but John Cleese particularly, has to do these, you know, acrobatic-like walks in ways while he is playing this erudite, you know, upper-class English, you know, government worker. And he's like, oh, forgive me, I have this very silly walk. It's taking me a while, you know. And he's like from the waist up, he is posh. And from the waist down, he is moving around like some freaky acrobat or something. And then, you know, Michael Palin's like, oh, with government support, I can make my walk very silly. You know, and he's like, well, it's not very silly yet, is it? You know, it's like, look, we have all these departments and this one's low on the totem pole. We're not going to lie. There's not a lot of money out there for walkers.
This one is on my list. It is higher. This is... I think one of their best sketches, and man, the showcase of John Cleese's physical comedy here. I've tried to do this walk. I tried. I mean, I'm almost 44 now. Like, my body doesn't move the way it used to. But even when I was, you know, young and spry, like, I couldn't do this. Like, I tried. It is so hard to imitate. Like, there are very few actors who I think can do this kind of physical stuff. The only one who comes to mind is maybe Steve Martin. Yeah. He's pretty bendy and wiggly. But, like, it's hard to put into words what he's doing if you haven't seen this. It's not just that he's walking silly. It's the way, like, the walk... What's silly about it keeps changing the way he like swivels one leg around the other as he does it while he's trying to, you know, condescend to Michael Palin. It's wild. This is just an incredible sketch.
Yeah. It's one of the ones that didn't make my list just purely because I wrote a paper on it for a movement class.
Wow.
And after you've spent like 3 weeks analyzing something to death, you can actually kill the comedy of something. Sure. It's like, I'm sure it could be enjoyable now, but I haven't been able to bring myself back to watch it in a while, just purely because I'm like, oh, that was grueling. That was grueling, going frame by frame, going, how does he do that? Okay. This is the stretch you would need to accomplish that.
Oh, the way he bends his legs up and back and stuff. It's like, wow, I didn't think a human pelvis could accommodate that kind of leg movement. It's pretty nuts. And also, this is go ahead.
Oh, go on. Oh, I was going to say, it's just the academic equivalent of never meet your idols. It's never meet your idols and never write papers about things you find funny. It will, it will ruin them forever.
Yeah, I also love that. What a great little satire piece this is about, like, wasteful government spending.
Yes.
Which they don't do a lot of. They do social satire in their own weird way. This one's a little more pointed than most. But yeah, and then poor Michael Palin with his like barely silly walk, where like he just has one leg like pop up every other step. And yeah, as you said, Rich, yeah, he has, with government backing, I believe I could make it very silly.
Yeah, yeah, we could develop this walk. He has a throwaway line in there where he's like, the Japanese have a man who can put his ankle behind his head on every step.
And then they show you that like footage that almost looks like silent movie footage of like other people, including John Cleese, but like others just doing these other silly walks. They must have had such a great time coming up with like how these weird walks are going to look.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. What a phenomenal sketch. All right, Ned, you're number four.
My number four is a vocational guidance counselor.
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 Ah, oh, Mr. Anchovy. Do sit down.
Thank you. Take the weight off the feet, eh?
Yes.
Lovely weather for the time of year, I must say.
Enough of this gay banter. And now, Mr. Andrew, you asked us to advise you which job in life you were best suited for.
That is correct, yes.
Well, I now have the results here of the interviews and the aptitude test that you took last week, and from them we've built up a pretty clear picture of the sort of person that you are. And I think I can say without fear of contradiction that the ideal job for you is chartered accountancy.
But I am a chartered accountant.
Darling, good. Well, back to the office with you, then.
No. Right. You don't understand. I've been a chartered accountant for the last 20 years. I want a new job. Something exciting that will let me live.
Well, chartered accountancy is rather exciting, isn't it?
Exciting? No, it's not. It's dull. Dull, dull. My God, it's dull. It's so desperately dull and tedious and stuffy and boring and desperately dull.
Well, yes, Mr. Angevin, but you see, your report here says that you are an extremely dull person.
You know, if you haven't seen the vocational guidance counselor sketch, John Cleese is playing a guidance counselor for a specific type of accountant, which my brain is not remembering so well right now. But the guy wants to get out of an accountancy, wants to, you know, do something else. So he goes to a vocational guidance counselor, takes the test, and the test comes back that he should be an accountant. It's then revealed, it's the twists and turns on this one, because it's then revealed he doesn't want to be an accountant anymore. He wants to be a lion tamer. Then we discover he has no idea what a lion is. He's getting it confused with an anteater. John Cleese tries to segue him into like, maybe you should consider something a little more dangerous than accounting, like banking, and it just keeps like staggering on this. And Michael Palin, who's the one that wanted to be the lion tamer, who brilliantly at one point is talking about, yes, banking, that could be exciting. And he picks up the chair he was sitting in talking about going into banking, but he's like thrusting the chair like he's a lion tamer. But what just kills me is at the end of the sketch, John Cleese just turns straight to camera and says, if you know someone who's stuck in the world of accountants, please get them to seek help. And they're like, this thing pops up for this, like the center to get children to not go into accounting. And it becomes this whole, like Rich talks about, like they like doing this where they could tie things into government institutions, but it was just, it's the warning that they put on the end of it and making it a PSA the whole time. I just thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Nice.
Great choice. My number four is How Not to Be Seen.
This is Mr. E.R. Bradshaw of Napier Court, Black Lion Road, Southeast 5. He cannot be seen. Now I'm going to ask him to stand up. Mr. Bradshaw, will you stand up, please? This demonstrates the value of not being seen. In this picture, we cannot see Mrs. B.J. Smegma of 13 The Crescent, Belmont. Mrs. Smegma, will you stand up, please? This is Mr. Nesbitt of Harlow, Newtown. Mr. Nesbitt, would you stand up, please? Mr. Nesbitt has learnt the first lesson of not being seen, not to stand up. However, he has chosen a very obvious piece of cover.
I this one and the fresh fruit one were kind of vying for this spot because they sort of have a similar premise, which is like you just violence. And it appears to be a government type, you know, PSA video about, you know, here's how you avoid being seen. Yeah. But every person that is, you know, they tell you where the person is, the person is immediately shot and then blown up. And then they start telling you, like, you know, all of the things they've done to locate where this person is. And they just keep escalating it until it's just this series of practically nuclear, actually literal. Like, yeah, I think they show like, you know, nuclear bomb footage going off. I don't know why I picked this other than, again, like, I remember just laughing my ass off so hard the first time I saw it. And I think it's all on John Cleese's very, very dry delivery.
Yeah. Now, this was on my honorable mentions for sure. And it was like, list or no list. But yeah, it's just so, you know, the way they just talk about and then, oh, they exploded, you know, and it's just, it's so subdued nature documentary where people are just exploding in front of you.
Rich, you're number three.
My number three, my top three are going to be probably exactly what you think they're going to be. Number three is Dead Parrot.
Now that's what I call a dead parrot.
No, it's stunned.
Look, my lad, I've had just about enough of this. That parrot is definitely deceased. And when I bought it not half an hour ago, you assured me that its lack of movement was due to it being tired and shagged out after a long squawk.
It's got me pining for the fields.
Pining for the fields? What kind of talk is that? Look, where did it fall flat on its back the moment I got it home?
The Norwegian blue prefers kipping on its back. It's a beautiful bird, lovely plumage.
Look, I took the liberty of examining that parrot, and I discovered that the only reason that it had been sitting on its perch in the first place was that it had been nailed there.
Well, of course it was nailed there, otherwise it muscled up to those bars and boom!
Look, matey, this parrot wouldn't voom if I put 4,000 bolts through it. It's bleeding demise.
It's not. It's pining.
It's not pining. It's passed on. This parrot is no more. It has ceased to be. It's expired and gone to meet its maker. This is a late parrot. It's a stiff. Bereft of life, it rests in peace. If you hadn't nailed it to the perch, it would be pushing out the daisies. It's run down the curtain and joined the choir invisible. This is an ex-parrot.
Like we said earlier, I love this version of it. I think it's a great, you know, a great sketch in of itself, but I think that they improved their comedic timing and they changed a few words here and there for the album version that I remember hearing more so than this that I like. But I still, you know, love this. It's Cleese and Palin back and forth. You know, Cleese is frustrated. Palin is lying but calm, which we will see again, which we've already talked about. And then, you know, it's just then he goes to a complaint department and then Terry Jones is like, well, I love these meta jokes they just throw in because I'm sure at the time it was like super, like, never been done before. It was now my old hat, but Terry Jones is the complaint department, and he's like, it's not easy to pad out these 30 minutes, you know, kind of thing, and he goes to the wrong shop, and or the right shop at the wrong thing, and the matte mustache, and then Graham Chapman comes out, get on with it, and then Eric Idle's like, all right, here's some full frontal nudity, and that's how they get out of the sketch.
Yeah, again, probably their single most famous sketch. This is their Who's On First or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But not without good reason. You know, again, okay. Of their, you know, guy is frustrated at a shopkeep sketches, it's very high up there. And again, like, there's so many quotable lines in there. This parrot wouldn't voom if you put 20,000 volts through it. As he is, I mean, the premise is just that he bought a parrot from this pet store. When he got it home, it was dead. He's now trying to return it, and the shop owner is trying to convince him that there's nothing wrong with this parrot. It's just sleeping. It's pining for the fjords. whatever he says to try and get him to, like,
pining for the fjords.
Go away. It's a classic for good reason.
Yeah,
so good, so good. Yeah, and that's one of the ones. It's like Some of the ones, it's funny. It's like, because with the nostalgia nature of this stuff in the podcast, I didn't actually include this because I feel like nostalgia is something that has to exist in the past. And it's like, I don't think a year's gone by in my life where some aspect of this hasn't come back into play. So it's like, it's always just still there. So it's just, it's like the best friend that I call once a year on their birthday. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ned, you're number three.
Oh, right. Sorry. I didn't do my... Wuthering Heights Semaphore.
From the pulsating pages of history, from the dark and furious days of Imperial Rome, we bring you a story that shattered the world. A tale so gripping that they said it could not be filmed. A unique event in cinema history. Julius Caesar on an Aldous lamp. From the makers of Gunfight at OK Corral in Morse Code. And the smoke signal version of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Yeah, this one stuck with me. And Rich, you can attest to this. I did a show in Chicago called The Literati, which was very much about bizarre adaptations of classical literature. And when I was rewatching this sketch, I was like, because it stuck in my brain forever. But when I was rewatching it, I was like, oh, this is literally where we came up with this idea from. They decide to do this big grand version of Wuthering Heights, but they're going to do it in semaphore. So it's just, I think Connie Chapman and Terry Jones just standing right across from each other with these big semaphore flags, just not talking to each other. And just waving them back and forth. Again, I realize I'm doing physical gestures on a podcast, which isn't helpful. But so they're doing semaphore, so you know, the flag language stuff. And it goes as far as to, like, you know, they're in the house and the old man's like sleeping and he's just waving a semaphore that just represents Z's, and the little baby in the cradle, two little flags pop out. And then it immediately jumps to Julius Caesar done on a signal lamp. And they are just acting out Julius Caesar clicking this lamp at each other. And then, I mean, it keeps going on from there. Like, I can't actually remember the last two things. The last thing was Gentlemen Prefer Blondes with smoke signals.
Wow.
And it just escalates. I can't even remember the third of the four because I was laughing so hard again. Just at the whole sketch, but yeah, that's, it's definitely one of my faves.
I'll have to check that one out. I do not remember that one.
Yeah, I don't either, but there's something about their ability, like, for as weird as things are, sometimes the premise is shockingly simple, you know, where it's like,
and there's,
yeah, go
ahead. No, I'm agreeing with you completely. They're just so in this, like, you would swear they are doing Julius Caesar. Like, they do not make any jokes of it at all. They commit to the drama of it. And it's just, I love it for that reason.
Yeah. They definitely love this kind of stuff. And again, it's like, it speaks to their love of like classical literature, you know, that kind of stuff. But also, yeah, it's like, what if someone was to perform one of these classical works using an unconventional, you know, presentation method, right? You know, semaphores, mm-hmm. smoke signals. And then it's just like, all right, well, once you've got that, the game, to use like sketch terms, locked in, like the rest of it kind of writes itself. But the performance of that, of just like, yeah, like you said, like the old man just making Z's, like they find ways to like, how can we turn the screw a few times on this weird but simple concept? They're masters at
mm-hmm.
it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, well, my number three is a different guy goes into a shop sketch. I was like, well, I do want to pick one of these. So I went with an emotional favorite, and that is Bookshop.
Mm. This is David Copperfield with 1P by Edmund Wells.
David Copperfield with 1P?
Yes, I should have said.
Yes, well, in that case, we don't have it.
Funny, you've got a lot of books here.
Yes, we do, but we don't have David Copperfield with 1P by Edmund Wells.
Are you quite sure?
Quite.
Not worth just looking?
Definitely not.
How about Great Expectations?
Yes, well, we have that.
That's G-R-A-T-E Expectations, also by Edmund Wells.
Yes, well, in that case, we don't have it. We don't have anything by Edmund Wells, actually. He's not very popular.
Not Nicholas Nickleby? That's K-N-I-C-K-E-R-L-E-S-S?
No.
Christmas Carol with a K?
No.
How about A Sale of Two Titties?
Definitely not.
Sorry to trouble you.
Not at all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh.
Yes?
I wonder if you might have a copy of Barnaby Budge.
No, as I say, we're right out of Edmund Wells.
No, not Edmund Wells. Charles Dickens.
Charles Dickens?
Yes.
You mean Barnaby Rudge?
No, Barnaby Budge by Charles Dickens. That's Dickens with two Ks, the well-known Dutch author.
No, well, we don't have a Barnaby Budge by Charles Dickens with two Ks, the well-known Dutch author, and perhaps to save time, I should add that we don't have Carnaby Fudge by Dahl's Chickens, or Farnborough Sludge by Miles Pickens, or even Stickwick Stapers by Fowles Wickens with four M's and a silent Q. Why don't you try W.H. Smith's?
I did. They sent me here.
Did they?
Where, you know, he's a guy wants to buy a Charles Dickens book. And, like, the whole thing, it gets so ridiculous. Like, I'm sorry, no, you wanted Charles Dickens, the author of, you know, The Tale of Two Cities, or whatever. It's like, oh, no, we don't have Barnaby Rudge by Charles Dickens. We have Barnaby Budge by Charles Dickens with two Ks. And, you know, again, same kind of premise they've done before, where it's like the shopkeep can't get you what you want. But it escalates in a weird way that I really love. And it's an emotional favorite for me because a friend and a guest on the podcast, Shakina Nafak, who was on our Rocky Horror Picture Show episode, we did this at like Jewish summer camp.
Nice.
Some sort of Jewish sleepaway camp, just to show what true nerds we both are. But I believe I was the one who convinced her to do the sketch. So like we got to do this. So we put this sketch on. And so, I have a personal connection to it, but yeah, just another just really silly, weird, heightened thing as they're going through all these different, like, titles and permutations of things that are not actual Charles Dickens books.
Yeah, love it.
All right, Rich, you're number two.
We've already talked about it. Cheese Shop. I love it. And then at the end, he shoots him. What a waste of human life. Puts on a cowboy hat, and that's the sketch. Yeah. Like, yeah, of course. Why wouldn't there be a cowboy hat at the end of this? Of course.
The cowboy hat thing was funny, too, just because it's one of those ones that I'm like, I don't all of a sudden know if I've seen the actual TV version until today, because I remember this so well from the recording, and I'm pretty sure I watched one of their live performances of it, but it definitely did not have him riding off into the sunset.
Hmm.
No, it's amazing they would find, considering these sketches don't have often conventional endings.
Yeah.
The fact that they would be able to like kind of redo them in these other audio formats, they would find different strange ways to transition in and out of these sketches that would still work. Yeah. Like they would somehow find a way to like rewrite the thing slightly to make that change. And even the visual stuff would still work in these audio like they would find ways like, okay, you can't see the two dudes dancing behind him. So it becomes it's just Bazooki music. You know, they retool it for the different format so well.
Yeah.
Ned, you're number two.
My number two is the courtroom charades sketch.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
We have, Muller.
And how do you find the defendant? Rope? String?
Knot! Knot!
Knot! Knot!
Swimmer?
Brian Phelps?
No, 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 he was a diver!
Fish!
Wheeze? Fish wheeze? Fish breeze throat.
Fish breeze throat.
Gill.
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 Not gill. Not gill. Not gill cup. Not gill cup. You've been found not gill cup of the charges brought against you, and you may leave this court a free man.
Which, you talk about unconventional endings. They actually brought back a convention for this. The courtroom charade sketch is guy's on trial. The lead juror stands up. They're like, have you reached your verdict? He's like, we have, Your Honor. And then proceeds to deliver the verdict via charades. But it's not that. It's going through. He's like pointing to his he's tying a rope. And he's like pointing at the knot in the center. And they're like, rope, string, tie, knot. And then he's doing a fish. And they're like, not swim, not fish, not breathe, not gill. And then he finally is holding a teacup. He's like, huh, we find the defendant not gill. And they're pointing at the cup. And he's like, not gill cup. You've been found not gill cup. And just, it's immediately accepted as fact. And it's the fact that that goes on. The judge does it. The scene goes on a little bit longer. And someone towards the end goes, oh, I'm sorry, I wasn't expecting the Spanish Inquisition. To which they cut to the three guys in their house running out the door, hopping on an actual London double-decker bus, riding through town, and running into the Old Bailey, one of the most prestigious courthouses in the world, in full Spanish Inquisition regalia, just running up the steps. And you see one of the MPs just sort of like looking awkwardly as they're running by going, what the hell? And you're like, you literally just filmed this on the street, didn't you? I love it. You did not, like, no care anymore. I loved it so much for that reason.
Brilliant.
Well, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. That's a recurring great sketch all on its own, and I can't believe I didn't even have it in my honorable mentions. But the Spanish, as you said, like it to bring that back, they would find ways to bring it in. But what you're talking about is that like man on the street stuff, like where they just filmed it out in London somewhere, and like you can tell, like they didn't get permits for this shit. It's all guerrilla filmmaking, and it's fantastic.
Hell yeah!
That's actually one of those things I've always wondered about because I never looked into it when I was over there. But so many of the British sketch shows did a lot of just shooting on the streets, like all the stuff with Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. They were shooting on the street all the time. So I'm wondering if there was. They even had to permit, man. It's Monty Python. If they had to permit, I doubt they cared.
Yeah.
No, not at all. All right. My number two is Ministry of Silly Walks.
Nice.
For all the reasons we already talked about, you know, there's so much in it that showcases all of their kind of, you know, logical weirdness, their the physical performance, the nuance and the acting. Just a great one. I do want to shout out the, I don't know if it's Carol Cleveland, but at one point, John Cleese's character calls in the secretary to bring him tea, and she has a silly walk. So she comes in like with this weird, she's almost like walking on her ankles and like she's jittering so much that like all of the tea spills everywhere. And she just walks in, jitters, spills everything. And he goes, oh, thank you. That'll be all. And then she just walks out the same way.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I just want to shout that out as a great part of the sketch.
That's so good.
All right. So before we get to our number ones, Rich, your honorable mentions.
I'm not going to take up too much time because there's so many, but some we haven't talked about. The lifeboat sketch, where they're all in a lifeboat in the middle of the ocean. They're deciding who's going to eat who. And then at one point, a waitress comes by and is like taking their order. And then they kind of lift up the boat and walk out. And it's just, it's brilliant absurdity that starts out as a kind of sketch. You'd think, okay, people stuck in a lifeboat, dying. What are they going to do? We've seen this premise before. And then they take it to absolute absurdity. I also had How to Not Be Seen, Exploding Penguins. And then the Agatha Christie sketch, which we haven't mentioned just because it's one where it's just dead body, shoot the dead body. Next person comes in, I'm an inspector, they die. Next, I'm an inspector, and you just have piles of dead body. And it's just like, oh, that's more death. Thank you, Monty Python.
Ned, any honorable mentions you want to shout out?
The two that I wanted to put on my list, and if I could have done 12, I would have been the Dirty Fork sketch.
Mm, brilliant.
Just purely for the, not just a brilliant sketch, but just like the fact that they just blatantly go, and now the punchline.
Yeah.
like that breaking of the fourth wall. And the chocolate shop, the sweet shop sketch would be the other big honorable mention I'd give. And also I would give honorable mention to seasons 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Just everything encompassed within there are on my honorable mentions as well.
True.
Yeah, no, the Crunchy Frog sketch is great.
The Crunchy Frog, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Real good. About chocolates that I think that you will, like, kill you. Like, springs pop out of them.
Well, it's just the ingredients. It's like, there's one of them. It's like, oh, and lovingly coated in lark's vomit. Lark's vomit?
Yeah, and I love
nobody
that.
Nobody is expecting lark.
Oh, I was going to say, like, I just love that, like, yeah, he's talking about this Crunchy Frog confection, and he thinks at first it's like, oh, okay, so it's like a chocolate frog. He's like, no, it's a real frog covered in chocolate. Like,
covered in chocolate.
Yeah.
Dusted in glucose. So. Yeah. Yeah, it's just...
I think my kids would like that one. So my honorable mentions, I'll just talk about the ones that haven't come up yet. Travel Agent, which is Eric Idle, just... this is another one of these, like, feats of memorization where he just is... he's complaining, but, like, it turns into this, like, 5-minute monologue as Palin is, like, pleading for him to shut up. It's very funny. Olympic Hide and Seek.
Yeah.
Is great. Nudge Nudge, sure. A big name sketch we haven't talked about. One of the few that does have, like, a real button on the end of it. Another Eric Idle. We haven't talked about Eric Idle much, really. So that's there. Upper Class Twit of the Year.
Sure.
And I think all these other ones we've talked about. Yeah, Cheese Shop, Exploding Penguin, Dirty Fork. So, all right. We've come to here the end. Rich, you're number one.
I would put this right up there with Who's On First and other monumental classic sketches. To me, Argument Clinic.
Is this the right one for an argument?
I've told you once.
No, you haven't.
Yes, I have.
When? Just now. No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
I'm telling you, I did.
You did not.
Oh, I'm sorry, is this a 5-minute argument or the full half hour?
Oh, just the 5-minute one.
Fine. Thank you. Anyway, I did.
You most certainly did not.
Now, let's get one thing quite clear. I most definitely told you.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
No, this isn't an argument.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. It's just contradiction.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
It is not.
It is. You just contradicted me.
No, I didn't.
Oh, you did.
No.
You did just
then. No, nonsense.
Oh, look, this is futile.
No, it isn't.
I came here for a good argument.
No, you didn't. You came here for an argument.
Well, an argument's not the same as contradiction.
Can be.
No, it can't. An argument's a connected series of statements to establish a definite proposition.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. It isn't just contradiction.
Look, if I argue with you, I must take up a contrary position.
But it isn't just saying no, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Argument's an intellectual process. Contradiction is just the automatic gainsaying of anything the other person says.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
Not at all.
No, look.
Thank you.
What?
That's it. Morning.
But I was just getting interested.
Sorry, the 5 minutes is up.
That was never 5 minutes just now.
I'm afraid it was.
No, it wasn't.
Sorry, I'm not allowed to argue anymore.
What?
If you want me to go on arguing, you'll have to pay for another 5 minutes.
Is their best sketch. Mm. And I, as we said, they have a lot of good sketches.
No, it isn't.
Yeah, yes, it is. But I think that there's something about the high concept of this. There's something about, like, the different layers that it goes through. It goes through different layers at the end when it's like the inspector comes. We're arresting you for this. And another inspector comes and he realizes he's doing the meta thing he's arresting them for. You know, and it's crazy. But the basic premise is a guy goes to pace. For a service, and that service is someone will argue with him. And it's not the only service offered. There's abuse, there's the complaints, and being hit on the head lessons. And it is, everyone gets to shine in the sketch, and it's brilliant.
Ned, you're number one.
My number one is the Kilimanjaro expedition.
So, you want to join my mountaineering expedition, do you?
Me, sir?
Yes?
Yes, I'd very much like to, sir.
Jolly good.
Jolly good.
And how about you?
There is only me, sir.
Well, bang goes his application, then. Now, let me fill you in. I'm leading this expedition, and we're going to climb both peaks of Mount Kilimanjaro.
I thought there was only one peak, sir.
Well, that'll save a bit of time. Well, then, now, the object of this expedition is to see if we can find any traces of last year's expedition.
Last year's expedition?
Yes, my brother was leading that. They were going to build a bridge between the two peaks. My idea, I'm afraid. Now, I ought to tell you that I have practically everyone that I need for this expedition, so what special qualifications do you have?
Well, sir...
Yes, you first.
There is only me, sir.
I wasn't talking to you. Carry on.
Well, I'm a fully qualified mountaineer.
Mountaineer? Mountaineer. I don't know. A mountaineer. Two men skilled in climbing mountains. Jolly good. Well, you're in. Congratulations.
So this sketch, it starts out, John Cleese is looking to lead a group of people on a trip to summit the two peaks of Kilimanjaro. And Eric Idle is the mountaineer. And for some odd reason, John Cleese sees double constantly. And there is only one peak of Kilimanjaro. They had sent a preview. I believe one of my favorite jokes that he's like, well, the purpose of this expedition is to retrieve the previous expedition who were trying to put a bridge between the two peaks of Kilimanjaro. And he'll just put his hand over his eye to like, go, oh, wait, yes. Because Eric Idle's repeated line is, there is only me, sir. it's so funny. And then Graham Chapman shows up in this just completely... like, don't worry about the eye thing. We'll take care of him. And he's like, okay, he's going to be leading the mountaineers. And Graham Chapman proceeds to climb through this set, destroying everything. Like, a bookcase full of books literally falls on Graham Chapman while this is going on. And he doesn't break stride at all. Just, like, keeps going as if nothing happened. Just walks out of the room. Great button at the end of it. I think it's just like Eric Idle's like, you know what? I'm not going to be any part of this because I think this is a terrible idea. And he walks out and John Cleese goes, what a shame. Well, how about you? And another Eric Idle is sitting there in the chair. And I'm just like, what's just happened? I love this. I love this so much.
I'm glad you mentioned this. I had forgotten about this one. And yeah, you're right. This again, like a simple premise heightened to infinity of like, yeah, okay, John Cleese has absolutely double vision. What can we make of double vision? And it's just, yeah, the whole idea of like there are two Kilimanjaros that he sees and that, yeah, the expedition died trying to bridge the two peaks. But as you said, the button at the end that there is a second Eric Idle is so inspired and weird.
I will absolutely say though, if you're looking to watch this on YouTube, be very careful because the version I saw also thought they would be clever by superimposing another John Cleese on top of it. And I'm like, that didn't happen. Why are you doing that? Leave it alone.
Yeah, we should mention, I believe the complete run of Flying Circus is on Netflix, so you can watch the real thing whenever you like.
Yes, correct.
Well, Rich, I'll make you happy. My number one is also Argument.
I kind of had a feeling, yeah.
Well, what?
That was never 5 minutes just now.
I told you I'm not allowed to argue. I just paid.
I just paid.
No, you didn't.
I did. I did. I did. No, no, I don't want to argue about that.
Well, I'm very sorry, but you didn't pay.
Aha! Well, if I didn't pay, why are you arguing? Gotcha.
There you have.
Is that? If you're arguing, I must have paid.
Not necessarily. I could be arguing in my spare time.
I've had enough of this.
No, you haven't.
Oh, shut up. I want to complain.
You want to complain? Look at these shoes. I've only had them 3 weeks and
they're
no,
I want to complain about
them. If you complain, nothing happens. You might just as well not bother. And my back hurts. And whenever you had a fine day,
I want to complain.
Oh! Hold your head like this and then go, wah! Try it again.
Whoa!
Better, but wah, wah. Hold your hands here.
No!
Now,
ah!
No, that's it, good!
Stop hitting me!
What?
Stop hitting me!
Stop hitting you?
Yes.
Well, what did you come in here for?
I came here to complain.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's next door. It's being hit on the head lessons in here.
What a stupid concept.
This was one of the ones that, again, I heard growing up when I was, you know, just a wee lad hearing this one before I even knew who Monty Python was. And I thought this was just one of the funniest things I had ever heard. Not just for like the cleverness and the logic of it, of like, we're going to do an argument and you have John Cleese immediately going just, no, it isn't. And then get into an argument over what an argument actually is philosophically. Yeah. Well, an argument is an intellectual process designed to establish a proposition. A contradiction is just the automatic gainsaying of anything the other person says, to which John Cleese just goes, no, it isn't. Yeah. just brilliantly funny. And then, as you said, the stuff around that, the fact that then he's out of time, right? It's like, oh, you only paid for a 5-minute argument. And he thinks he's got him by saying like, well, you know, if I haven't paid, why are you arguing with me? And he's, well, I could be arguing with you in my spare time. Like, so fucking good. That they build all of that. And then, yeah, still they do their Monty Python stuff on like at the beginning and the end of it, where, as you said, he says, oh, fuck this, and walks off to then go into the being hit on the head lessons or whatever he stumbles into. And I believe, is this one of the ones where Graham Chapman comes in his like Generalissimo outfit and says, right, stop that, it's silly, and like shuts the whole thing down?
Yeah, like he comes in, the last place they had the hitting on the head lessons. So Chapman comes in, flying fox of the yard. And he, like, you know, he's hitting them and he's, oh, very nice, very nice. And to me, this was the first time it kind of occurred to me that they probably were fans of the Three Stooges. Because there are moments here where you can see, like, oh, there's a little bit of Stooges influence, I think, in Python. I can't swear by that. I don't know. I've never heard him talk about it, but... Anyway, this just kind of made me feel like it was. But then, so he's in there, and then Eric Idle comes in as the second inspector to arrest the first inspector for being meta. And it's just, you know, layer, layer, layer.
Yeah. Again, like, this takes the smartest guys in the world to write. Yeah. The conceptualization on this is just absolutely top tier. And is rivaled, I think, only by some of, like, I think the best bits in their movies.
Yes.
So I will leave open, of course, you know, we'll keep this podcast open after we log off for future episodes on the movies, because they're all worth talking about. But, guys, thanks so much for coming on to talk about Monty Python. I'll do what I do at the end of this podcast is, you know, I'll throw it to you, Rich. Why do you think it is we're still talking about Monty Python? You know, here we are, you know, God, what, 5 decades after the show went off the air?
Yeah. I want to answer your question, but just real quick, I just want to shout out to Terry Gilliam, because we mentioned him very briefly in the beginning, but, you know, none of us were going to put any Terry Gilliam, like, animations on our sketches, because they're not really sketches, but his animations did give this show a feeling and a flavor and kind of resets in between segues kind of thing that really made the show great, and I don't think he gets as much credit as the guys who you see their faces. So just because we talked about all the five so much, though, I just want to throw him out there. But to answer your question, why do we still talk about it? It's the best sketch comedy of its time ever. Like, it was ranked in 2020. They did Rolling Stone did a poll on best sketch comedy of all time. It was number one, right? I don't know any sketch comedian. I don't know any comedian. I don't know anyone who likes comedy who's my age or older who wasn't influenced by, on some level, Monty Python. Even if you weren't directly, you were in anyone who you laugh at almost certainly was influenced by them. Like, they're not only mega popular with the masses, but they are comedians as well, which is an extremely hard thing to do both at the same time, like we talked about with Mitch Hedberg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ned, how about you? What, your thoughts on why Monty Python endures?
I think Monty Python endures genuinely for the same reason that people like William Shakespeare endures, that if you are able to communicate something and reach people on a certain level, you will never go out of style. Like, everyone's like, oh, comedy is timeless. I'm like, some comedy is timeless. Most comedy I see nowadays is incredibly outdated, possibly by the time it airs. But Monty Python, almost like they follow the principle that I can't remember who it was. They used to write predominantly for cartoons. And they said, oh, when you write a joke for a cartoon, you have to be very, very careful because what's funny right now, by the time we write the joke, record the joke, animate the joke, get it to air, there's no guarantee it's still going to be funny. And this is barring, obviously, South Park, who can write a show 6 days before it airs.
Yeah.
But Monty Python is able to capitalize on that. You know, all of these jokes, all these sketches we're talking about, maybe there was some pop culture reference at the time that we are missing out on, but we're not really missing that much out on it because we still find it hilarious. They're still able to like distill it down to what's just funny. So that's why I think we're still talking about it, is that they figured out the essence of human nature and capitalized on it.
Yeah.
You know, Rich, going back to that Mitch Hedberg episode, we talked a lot about the mechanics of comedy and how it kind of works under the hood. Yeah. And the joy of sort of getting in there. I feel like Monty Python, it's almost as if these guys opened up a window into the clockwork of reality and were like, what if we yanked out all the gears and reassembled them? Like, and there's something about the way they do that that makes this stuff truly timeless, because it does not require it to be moored in time. It's because it's so absurd and not generally tied to anything particularly topical. It will be funny forever. And there's something about the way they not only, yes, some of their jokes are straight up just, this is a funny idea. But because they play with the form so much, they break the mold at almost every turn. They almost break it to the point where no one can ever break it again. Like, yeah. No, you can't bend reality much farther than Monty Python bends it, while still displaying like absolute command of the jokes, right? Like, we've talked about some of these sketches where, like, you know, they don't make any sense on paper. They barely make any sense when you watch them. And yet there's this sense of like everything is like fine-tuned to a purpose within an inch of its life somehow. Like, the precision with which they deliver all of this absurdity is kind of like the magic that holds it all together. And I can't think of anything that's come before or since that does what these six guys did. There's a lot of great British comedy out there. We talked about Douglas Adams. Douglas Adams is kind of like the written equivalent of this, but even he doesn't bend things and break them quite as far as Monty Python did. And so this stuff is, like you mentioned, Who's on First, right? This stuff that will, like, legendarily funny stuff that will stand the test of time and be there forever. And Monty Python, yeah, they're all absolutely, to a man, like, just the some of the funniest people of all time. So, 100%. I'm very glad we got to talk about this. Before we go, you know, if people like Monty Python, is there anything you would recommend that they check out?
Yeah, I mean, lots. You know, obviously, you said Flying Circus. As of we're recording this, it's all on Netflix, which is great. Their three movies are great, and I would say that a lot of audio recordings, you can find different things. The Monty Python's The Final Ripoff was probably the CD I listened to the most of, but there's plenty of stuff out there for people who are uninitiated.
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about their songs very much at all. There's a lot of Monty Python songs that are very, very funny and memorable, but just didn't make our list. Ned, anything you would recommend, either Monty Python or things perhaps in the same vein?
Well, okay, I would say if anyone listening hasn't tapped into the Monty Python world yet, I mean, I definitely recommend Holy Grail as sort of the entryway, because it is such it's the most coherent plot of everything, followed by Life of Brian. But I feel like between the two of them, Holy Grail gives you more of the idea of what the show was like. And then beyond that, there's so much out there. I just recently binge the Holy Hell through Letterkenny, and I could see so much of that kind of influence of this Monty Python world, not quite so far-fetched, but just that how you can be incredibly intelligent 1 minute and jump to a fart joke 10 seconds later and jump back seamlessly without ever having an issue. There's so many of those things. And, you know, guys like The Kids in the Hall and all these other great things to check out. If you are a Monty Python's fan, The State, you know, definitely The State.
I'll recommend a couple other Britcom or British comedy things that are, mm-hmm. I think, owe some kind of a debt to Python. One is Blackadder, which is a very funny sitcom starring Rowan Atkinson, who you know as Mr. Bean, or if you're young enough, Zazu from The Lion King. But yeah, as playing like a different version of this, like, he's like this cursed character, Blackadder. And so like each season is a different like member of his family through time as he deals with being put upon and miserable. But it's him and Hugh Laurie and some others that are just incredibly funny. The other thing I will mention, which is almost like what if there was a way to try and recreate what Monty Python is like live, is a show called Taskmaster, which is fucking incredible. It's all on YouTube. And this is the hosts will they have five comedians. As the quote unquote contestants, and they're given these seemingly simple tasks to do, usually independently of another. So none of them know what the other one did. And sometimes it's really simple. It's like, you know, there could be a physical task, like, you know, whoever can drop this egg from the tallest height without breaking it wins the task. Right. Or sometimes it's more creative, like, you know, make a movie that's 30 seconds long using only the objects in this room, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And their creativity challenges. But it's incredibly like funny and satisfying to watch these comedians try and think their way through these problems and sometimes rules lawyer their way around the problem. But there is something Python-esque to the approach to this and the absurdity of the tasks. So you will not have a bad time watching an episode of Taskmaster. So that's my recommendation.
Nice. And have you watched the New Zealand one yet?
I have not. I bet it's good.
Watch. It's the Australia one didn't do so well. New Zealand one's worth checking out. Also QI on that same track as a lot of these same comedians sort of. It's kind of what if the cast of Monty Python was forced to do pub trivia.
I would think the cast of Monty Python would do extremely well at trivia.
Yeah, and they do on this show, but it's pretty hilarious.
All right, Rich, if people want to find you and your good works, where do they find it?
If you want to take an improv class online that is all about support and not anything that's risky or scary, go to richbakercoaching.com and you get a free first-time drop-in for any of my improv classes.
There you go. Ned, anything people should search for if they want to find cool stuff that you do?
You can go to nedrecord.com. It's usually got either what I've been acting in, what I just directed, links to my leatherworking sites, you know, weird stuff like that.
There you go. I'll put links to that in the show notes, of course, so people can find that. Of course, if you like this show, I'll put the links to all of our social media portals in the notes there. But we're on all the usual social media places. If you have the time and are so inclined, it would be awesome if you could drop a review on the show at iTunes or wherever you happen to find this podcast, because that makes a big difference in terms of visibility. Normally, this is where I would tell you, if you have thoughts on our previous episodes, which include X, Y, and Z, and our upcoming episodes, I would tell you that. However, I'm recording this so far in advance that I don't know what those things are. So just look around at the other podcast episodes that happen to be next to it and tell us what you think. So that's what I've got for that. But things in the works currently that could be recent. We're talking about doing A League of Their Own. So that could be recent as you hear this. We're going to do one on our favorite TV theme songs. So that might be in the mix. We'll be recording one on The Big Lebowski next week, so you'll hopefully hear that soon. So there is good stuff that you either just heard or are about to hear, as always. So, Rich, Ned, thanks again for dropping by and doing something completely different.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Doug.
All right, and so until next time, that is one more entry in the Nostalgium Arc.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition! Our chief weapon is surprise. Surprise and fear. Fear and surprise are two weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency are three weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency and an almost fanatical devotion to the Pope are four. No. Amongst our weapons. Amongst our weaponry are such elements as fear. Are coming again.